Lumumba's bonds are tightened. They were taking no chances. And his wife and child watch his humiliation. The whole affair, of course, serves to underline once again the conditions prevailing in the Congo. It's not enough to arrest a man. He must apparently be beaten up as well. Then put him on trial later, no doubt. As for Mobutu's troops, they yelled and danced with joy. They had won a great victory. They had got Lumumba after trying to lay their hands on him for months.
Пламенного крик Конго Алани с авторской ордой Убит герой твой молодой
Лумумба с нами Лумумба с нами Брат наш боевой Лумумба имя Лумумба знамя Лумумба сердце Африки живой
Земля твоя сейчас, Конго, твой гнев священный не указ, Конго, здесь миллионы встанут дубой, гордится мир твоей борьбой.
Good day, and welcome to another episode of an awesome show highlighting African literature and music, Africa's Lit. I'm your host, Daniela, and today I'll spare you the intro that usually leaves you wanting and just crying for more. I'm just going to get right to it. Today's book is The Poisonwood Bible by Barbara Kingsolver. I initially read this book in the early 2010s, and it stuck with me. When I heard Africa Center was doing reading Poisonwood Bible, I was very excited because I felt like I remembered everything. So I was hooked, I'm not going to lie. What could this story be about that had me hooked? So, well, it is a story of a white family moving to the Congo in the 1950s, and this would be the Democratic Republic of Congo. Now, what could have made this white author, Barbara Kingsolver, write a story about a white family moving to Democratic Republic of Congo in the 1950s? I don't know. But that's basically what I think makes this novel pretty interesting. Also, what makes this novel pretty interesting is that Barbara Kingsolver, in my research, is someone who does not write outside of her her demographic, if that makes sense. There are a lot of times when we read books by authors who don't meet the either gender, race, maybe religious beliefs or sexual orientation of the protagonists of their authors who are speaking in first person. And I always find it interesting, but it's also a wonderful way to create. Like, there's this huge balance, I think, that needs to be found if you choose that to write but that way. But Barbara Kingsolver is not one to do that. She writes, she will only write as a white female. So that's who we will be seeing this story through the eyes from of. So yes, it is a massive novel, but a page turner that you can read again and again. It is told using the narratives of the women in the Price family. So it's the Price family who goes down to the Congo or DRC. Now we've got Orleana Price. She is the devoted wife. We have Rachel Price, the eldest daughter who misses the comforts of good old USA. Leah and twin sister Ada. Leah is a full-on daddy's girl, and Ada is kind of scientific. She's got a physical disability. And little Rachel. Little Ruth May. Ruth May is 5 years old and just basically makes friends with all the other children in the village. So this story, why is this family going to the DRC? Because father, patriarchal head, Nathan Price, is a missionary pastor and believes and has been called to duty in the DRC and brings his family with him. So this story, we kind of get to see the happenings of everything going on, which will include the independence of the DRC through the eyes of four daughters and the wife of Mr. Nathan Price. Now, according to the publisher HarperCollins, the story is told by the wife and four daughters of Nathan Price, a fierce evangelical Baptist who takes his family and mission to the Belgian Congo in 1959. They carry with them everything they believe they will need from home, but soon find that all of it, from garden seeds to scripture, is calamitously transformed on African soil. The novel is set against one of the most dramatic political chronicles of the 20th century, the Congo's fight for independence from Belgium, the murder of its first elected prime minister, the CIA coup to install his replacement, and the insidious progress of a world economic order that robs the fledgling African nation of its autonomy. Against this backdrop, Orleana Price reconstructs the story of her evangelist husband's part in the Western assault on Africa, a tale indelibly darkened by her own losses and unanswerable questions about her own culpability. Also narrating the story by turns are her four daughters, the teenaged Rachel, adolescent twins Leah and Ada, and Ruth May, a precious five-year-old. These sharply observant girls who arrive in the Congo with racial preconceptions forged in 1950s Georgia will be marked in surprisingly different ways by their father's intractable mission and by Africa itself. Ultimately, each must strike her own separate path to salvation. Their passionately intertwined stories become a compelling exploration of moral risk and personal responsibility. According to operaresidences.com.au, I will read another blurb about the book. The Poisonwood Bible delves into a myriad of controversial themes that continue to resonate with readers. One of the central themes explored in the novel is the clash of cultures and the destructive consequences of imperialism. Through the experiences of the Price family in the Belgian Congo, Barbara Kingsolver examines the detrimental effects of colonization and the ways in which it leads to exploitation, cultural erasure, and violence. Another controversial theme explored in the novel is the role of gender and feminism in a patriarchal society. Kingsolver presents a nuanced portrayal of the female characters in the Price family, each grappling with their own struggles against societal expectations and gender roles. These women navigate a world that seeks to marginalize and subjugate them, but also find strength and agency in their own unique ways.
Louisa, Mali Wapiliza Wenda lingi komona mama Luisa Bonga pesa na bo waneo Wapi Luisa Solo bo wane beta kida Beli ndanda Beli kembe wanga
So, who is this Barbara Kingsolver lady? According to her website, she was born in 1955 and grew up in rural Kentucky. Wikipedia says that when she was seven, her father, a physician, took the family to Leopoldville, Congo, which is now known as Kinshasa, Democratic Republic of the Congo. And so it is speculated that some of this story relates to her experiences. However, she doesn't flat out deny it specifically, but she says not everything she writes has to do with who she knows and what she's lived through, who knows. She earned degrees in biology from DePauw University and the University of Arizona. She's worked as a freelance writer and author since 1985. She has worked in Europe, Africa, Asia, Mexico, and South America, and currently resides in southwestern Virginia. The Poisonwood Bible is her eighth published novel, and I read on edubirdie.com that her writings are mainly based on the survival of people in harsh and unreceptive environments. However, she manages to dig out the hidden beauty of life in even such circumstances. She has been quoted as saying, and this was in relation to the Democratic Republic of Congo and the role of the U.S. In, I guess, that time of independence, she's been quoted, "If we had dropped an atomic bomb on the Congo in 1960 and walked away from that country never to return, the death toll would have been lower than what we did." I do know from my research that she is a believer in taking action against climate change, or like against the negative negative effects of climate change, and just playing her part. I think she challenged herself and her family, and she wrote a book about it, to eat locally for 1 year. And so that is something she practices, is that alongside, I guess writing about survival in harsh conditions. I wanted to play a little clip of her. This is a recent clip of her in relation to her most recent novel, but it describes how she comes up with her stories. And this was in conversation, or like at a lecture at Stanford Graduate School of Education. So yes, I had mentioned earlier that sometimes she brings up controversial themes. And so let's see how she tackles those.
Generally speaking, my process is that I start with an idea. I begin with theme. Not a lot of... we all do this differently. Mm-hmm. Every... Is that...
No.
Is it time to wake up?
No.
That's my alarm clock. The bamboo. As I say, okay, every... You ask a writer how she writes a novel, and you're going to get, you know, a different answer from mine. But I begin with the big idea, and then I spend usually a couple of years thinking, like, how do I get into the big idea? what will be the story be that will tell you? And it's really a question. I kind of start with a question, a big question that maybe I don't know the answer to or I'm hazy on, and I'd like to write my way to an answer. So how to get into it? I usually think several years about what is the plot that will ask that question or that will kind of lead, like bring us to an answer. Then who are the people? I invent characters and plug them in. It's like I bring a cast of characters, and they have to do exactly what I say. Mm-hmm. Okay? So, because I've already got that laid out. And it's so funny, people always ask, well, are this based on real people? Do you write about your friends or your family? No. Nobody I know would be that cooperative. They wouldn't, so I invent, you know, I sort of, it's a little bit like being a therapist in reverse. I begin with action, and then I back up and give them the appropriate damage, you know, that will lead them to the choices that they make. So that's kind of how I work. Appropriate damage, yeah. And sometimes if they won't do it, I back up and give them more damage. But you have to, you know, it's sort of like I'm not a person who would jump out of a second story window, light a fire behind me. I will do it. So that's so it's all, you know, just a lot of invention, a lot of creation. And I used to be offended when people thought every single thing in my book was true and it was all based on real people or me. Isn't it interesting? If you write a nonfiction book, everybody doubts your facts. Write a novel and they think every bit is true. I just, you know, I thought, no, it's not. I made it up. It's much harder than that. You know, I'm not just like recording. I'm inventing. But then I decided to take it as a compliment. If I convinced you, if you think all these people are real, then I've done my job.
Kiri ki bamba hiere. Kiri ki bamba hiere. Kiri ki bamba hiere. Kiri ki bamba hiere.
Kiri ki bamba.
Wanduku wapendie, wanduku wapendi. Mukuya tucheze, mchezo ya kwetwe. Mchezo ya kwetwe, yeye mchezo ya kwetwe. Cheze kaingula, cheze kaingula. Sangasi ukuye, yeye sangasi ukuye. Kiri kaume, kiri kaume. Wanduku wapendi, wanduku wapendi. Mukuya tucheze, mchezo ya kwetwe. Mchezo ya kwetwe, yeye mchezo ya kwetwe. Cheze kaingulo, cheze kaingulo. Sangasi ukuye, yeye sangasi ukuye. Kiri kaume, kiri kaume.
Welcome back to Africa's Lit. I'm your host, Daniela. And I just played for you a song by Abeti Masikini with Kiki Bamba. And the start of the show, you heard the song of Lumumba, sung by the Soviet choir. And you heard Wendell Colosoy, Marie-Louise. So today's book is The Poisonwood Bible, written by Barbara Kingsolver. And it is set in 1950s Democratic Republic of Congo. It follows the narratives of the women in the Price family as they follow Nathan Price, father, husband, and missionary on God's call to the DRC. So we just learned a little bit about today's author. I wanted to get into the setting. So let's learn a little bit about the DRC. Now, what I'm going to play for you, though, is not pre-colonial because, unfortunately, I couldn't tie that into the show because the setting is kind of colonial, post-colonial. So that is what we will be dealing with, mainly the 1950s and 60s DRC, but also how it kind of arrived to where it is in the book. So I have for you a clip off of TRT World channel on YouTube that shares a bit on the colonial history of the DRC.
136 years ago, German Chancellor Otto von Bismarck invited the rest of Western Europe to the Berlin Conference. The task? To carve up the map of Africa with total disregard for cultural, political, ethnic, or linguistic differences, and without a single African at the table. Among other things, this led to one of the greatest mass murders in history by the king of one of Europe's smallest states. Here's how it happened. The leaders of the Berlin Conference hoped that by chopping Africa up and deciding artificial arbitrary lines among themselves, they could avoid fighting with each other over who owned what, and could civilize local populations with Christianity. While unexplored countries were given mostly to nations, there was one exception. It's the country now called the Democratic Republic of Congo, but at the Berlin Conference, it was named the Congo Free State, and handed over as the personal property of Belgium's King Leopold II. He agreed to send over Christian missionaries and turn the territory into a free trade area for all of Europe, as well as to help the local population. But the Congo Free State became anything but free for the people that lived there. A worldwide boom in rubber meant that Leopold II could cash in big time, but tapping rubber from trees was backbreaking work. So to source enough labor, Leopold effectively turned all of the Congo into a slave plantation. The labor policy was known by some as the red rubber system, and it was designed to maximize extraction. The system was enforced by the Force Publique, Leopold's private colonial army, a 19,000-man military with white officers and black soldiers from as far as Zanzibar, Nigeria, Liberia, and even the Congo. Many of the soldiers had been kidnapped in raids on villages in their childhood and brought to Roman Catholic missions where they received military training. They were armed with modern weapons and the chicot, a bullwhip made of hippopotamus hide. Villagers were asked to meet insane rubber quotas. If a village didn't meet its targets, the military were expected to take hostages and shoot them. Women in villages were often held hostage or raped to speed up production. Severed limbs of villagers had to be produced as evidence that each bullet fired had been used to kill a villager. So if a soldier missed a shot, they would often cut off the hand of an innocent victim just so they could produce a limb to show their superiors. If individuals in a village refused to work, they were beaten or shot, and the village was razed to the ground. The red rubber system led to the collapse of economic and cultural life for the Congolese. A system so cruel that female hostages often starved while men were worked to death. Those that tried to flee into forests often died of hunger. Tens of thousands were shot in failed uprisings, and because farming had been disrupted, local Congolese were susceptible to famine and disease. The precise figures are not known, but estimates suggest that between 1880 and 1920, at least 10 million people, or 50% of the entire population, died. Leopold II never set foot in the Congo. But aside from murdering half of its population, he also imported 267 men, women, and children to set up a human zoo on the grounds of his country estate in Belgium. There, they were displayed behind a fence and assigned to zoo visitors, which read, "Don't feed the animals." Horror stories from missionaries eventually spread to Europe, and Leopold was forced to sell the Congo Free State to the Belgian government in 1908. The red rubber system was outlawed. But even though labor practices weren't as brutal as they were under Leopold II, many of his racist and exploitative practices continued to be implemented. The administration that ran the Congo Free State wasn't even replaced. 50 years after Leopold's human zoo, Belgium built another mock African village at a 1958 Belgium World Fair. The Congolese who traveled to Belgium thought they were part of a cultural exchange, but they found themselves part of a live display behind a fence. 52 years after Belgium took control of the country, the Congo won its independence in 1960. Despite Belgium's bloody history in the Congo, Belgians were taught that their country had brought civilization to Africa and that Leopold was a foundational figure for decades. Streets and parks have been named after him, and statues of him exist around the country. But in recent years, this narrative has come under fire. In the wake of the Black Lives Matter protests, young Belgians protested Leopold II's statues. And for the first time in 112 years, Belgium's King Philippe expressed regret for the suffering and humiliation his nation inflicted on the region. But he still didn't go as far as to apologize for the atrocities.
Today's novel, The Poisonwood Bible, is a fictional story set in the DRC at the time of elections and independence. It's told through the viewpoints of a wife and four daughters to a missionary pastor from the U.S.
He'd slowed me down till we were walking at an absolute snail's pace. It made me nervous. But he was going to tell me his secret if I just waited. I could tell he was itching to, so I didn't ask. I know a thing or two about men. Finally, here it came. Somebody's going to die, he announced. Well, big surprise, I said. Somebody dies around here about every 10.5 seconds. But of course I wondered who. I felt a little scared, but still didn't ask. We kept walking step by step. I had to. He still had his arm around me. Somebody that matters, he said. Everybody matters, I informed him. In the eyes of our Lord Jesus Christ, they do. Even the sparrows that fall out of their little nests and whatnot. He positively snorted at that. Princess, you have much to learn. Alive, nobody matters much in the long run, but dead, some men matter more than others. I was sick of his guessing game. All right then, who? He put his mouth so close to my ear I could feel his lips on my hair. He whispered, Lumumba. Patrice Lumumba, the president? I asked out loud, startled. Or whatever he is, the one they elected? As good as dead, he said in a quiet, so-what voice that chilled my blood. Do you mean to tell me he's sick or something? I mean his number is up. He's going to get it. And how would you happen to know that? I would happen to know that, he said, mocking me, because I'm in a position to know. Take my word for it, sister. Yesterday, Big Shot sent a cable to Devil One with orders to replace the new Congolese government by force. I intercepted the news in code on my radio. My own orders will be coming before the end of the week, I guarantee you. Now that was so much bunk, I'm sure, because nobody in our village has a radio. But I let him go on talking in his little riddles if that was what buttered his toast. He said Devil One was supposed to get his so-called operatives to convince the army men to go against Lumumba. Supposedly, this Devil One person was going to get $1 million from the United States to pay soldiers to do that, go against the very person they all just elected. $1 million, when we couldn't even get 50 measly greenbacks a month for our bread and board. That was a likely story. I almost felt sorry for Axel Root, wanting so bad to impress me into kissing him again that he'd make up ridiculous stories. I may be a preacher's daughter, but I know a thing or two, and one of them is when men want to kiss you, they act like they're just on the brink of doing something that's going to change the whole wide world.
Tu as toujours été belle. Tu as au moins ça pour toi. Tu étais naturelle. Je t'ai préféré comme ça. J'ai ôté tes guenilles. T'ai mis tes vêtements de choix. Car à mes yeux tu brillais. De doigts, le monde a changé. Ne parlant que de toi. Dès que les enchères se sont mises à grimper, je ne faisais plus le poids. Arrêté, tu as passé ton chemin, mon ego.
été. Pour toi, je ne vaux plus rien. Aujourd'hui, je peux plus t'appeler. Moi, je ne peux plus t'appeler. Personne ne peut plus te parler. Tu es la femme de quelqu'un. Mes sentiments n'ont pas changé. Mes sentiments n'ont pas changé.
So that song is called La Femme de Quelqu'un, sung by Singila and Kofi Olamide. And I chose it because there, in my research behind the music of today's episode, I came across a term called Mwakela. And Mwakela is a term used to describe hidden meanings behind words. And so that song, La Femme de Quelqu'un, translates to someone's woman. And it made me think that perhaps I read that there might be some Mwakela in there. And I tied it to someone else's woman. And we just heard a little bit from the book about, you know, Patrice Lumumba. There's a conspiracy about his future, although we all know what happened, and if you don't, you'll find out real soon. And so someone else's woman, like someone else's government, perhaps, maybe some political Mwakela going on around there. But yes, speaking of Patrice Lumumba, I'm going to play for you some information on him. There is basically no DRC, no Democratic Republic of Congo without Patrice Lumumba. So this TRT channel on YouTube, here we are again with some details on who some would call one of the most honorable men in African history.
Malcolm X called him the greatest black man who ever walked the African continent, while Belgium and the US plotted his assassination. His name was Patrice Lumumba, the first prime minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's considered by many a martyred hero, a symbol of anti-imperialism and pan-African unity. This is the story of how Lumumba came to power, dreaming of a better future for the Congo and Africa, and how that dream quickly turned into a nightmare as he was arrested and murdered in January of 1961, less than 7 months after independence.
La République du Congo a été proclamée. Et notre pays est maintenant entre les mains de ses propres enfants. Nous allons établir ensemble la justice sociale et assurer que les terres de notre patrie profitent véritablement à ses enfants. Voilà, sire, excellences, mesdames, messieurs, mes chers compatriotes, mes frères de lutte, mes frères de race, voilà ce que j'ai voulu vous dire. Vive l'indépendance de l'unité africaine. Vive le Congo indépendant et souverain.
Lumumba was born in 1925 in the village of Onalua in Kasai province in the Congo. At the time, his country, the DRC, was a Belgian colony, the Belgian Congo. He was a member of the small Bateta ethnic group. His entry into politics started at the grassroots level. In 1955, Lumumba became regional president of a Congolese trade union of government employees, as well as an active member of the Belgian Liberal Party in the Congo. The trade union he was running was not affiliated to the two main Belgian federations, much to the ire of Belgium's colonial administrators. In 1956, he was invited by the Ministry of Colonies to a study tour in Belgium, which he attended only to be arrested upon his arrival back to the Congo with charges of embezzling money from the post office. He served a 12-month sentence, and once free, Lumumba launched the Congolese National Movement, or the MNC, the first nationwide political party in the Congo. In 1958, the same year he launched this party, Lumumba attended the first All-African People's Conference in Accra, Ghana. His vision and Pan-African vocabulary impressed at the gathering and turned eyes across the continent. Taking notice of the nationalist fervor on the rise across Africa and with anti-colonial independence struggles at full throttle, the Belgian government announced local elections in December 1959. Lumumba's MNC wanted to boycott the race, deeming it an illegitimate Belgian attempt at installing a puppet government. Many Congolese boycotted in protest, and the Belgian authorities responded with repression. 30 Congolese were killed in Stanleyville, Kisangani, and Lumumba was arrested on charges of inciting a riot. The MNC changed its tactics and decided to join the election race. They claimed a sweeping victory with 90% of the vote and demanded the release of Lumumba in order to discuss the formation of a government and national independence. Their demands were met, and Lumumba became the first prime minister of his country in 1960. On Independence Day, while the King of Belgium was attending and the world was watching, Lumumba delivered a powerful speech that would live on as a benchmark for the anti-imperial struggle in Africa and the world. Immediately after Congolese independence and the start of Lumumba's prime ministership, units of the army rebelled, largely because of objections to their Belgian commander. Belgium sent in 6,000 troops, announcing that they were in place for the protection of Belgian nationals in the country. A day later, a man named Moise Tshombe took advantage of the power struggle and proclaimed the secession of the mineral-rich province of Katanga from the Congo, with support from the Belgian government and mining companies. In reality, it was a treacherous move. The Belgian troops protected and supported Tshombe's rebellion. They had moved in to secure its colonial cash cow and undermine Lumumba's rule. Running out of options, Lumumba reached out to the United Nations to expel Belgian forces and help restore internal order. Lumumba requested UN troops to suppress the rebellion in Katanga, but the UN forces were not authorized to do so under their mandate. The United States and France also refused to budge. Frustrated with the West, Lumumba tilted the balance and reached out to the Soviet Union, requesting planes to fly his army to Katanga. Lumumba, a skilled statesman, also assembled African heads of state in Leopoldville, Kinshasa, asking for their full support in his efforts to quell the rebellion and unify the DRC. But by turning to the Soviet Union, he had now crossed the Cold War red line, and the presence of Soviet military in the heart of Africa, gaining influence in a resource-rich country, made Western powers uncomfortable. To put it in perspective, the US had actually used uranium from the Congo when it dropped bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. So the Congo was very important for the US and its Western allies. But Lumumba's problems did not end there. Internally, he was up against President Kazavubu, who did not approve of Lumumba's actions and wanted a moderate, pro-Western approach and policy. The president fired Lumumba from his position on the 5th of September 1960, after less than 3 months in power, and placed him under house arrest. Lumumba rejected the dismissal on legal grounds, and the two were trapped in a power struggle. A few days later, Army General Mobutu Sese Soko, backed by Belgium and the USA, stepped in and took control of the government. Mobutu reached a working agreement with Kazavubu, and the UN had decided to recognize the legitimacy of the Kazavubu-Mobutu government. When Lumumba tried to escape home confinement, Mobutu had Lumumba arrested again and sent him to Katanga's secessionist forces. Lumumba, alongside two of his associates, Joseph Okito and Maurice Mpolo, were treated deplorably while being held captive. Eventually, on 17th January 1961, the three men were executed by a firing squad with the full knowledge and collaboration of the Belgians. Initially, their bodies were thrown in shallow graves, but later, under the direction of Belgian officers, the bodies were dug up, hacked into pieces, and dissolved in acid. The Katangan government initially tried to hide his death and provide a fake version of events. Their version was quickly disputed, but it took decades to provide the proof of what had happened. Lumumba's death was a shock for Africa and the global anti-colonial movement. In 2002, Belgium apologized to the Congolese people for its role in Lumumba's assassination. In 2013, the US State Department admitted that President Dwight Eisenhower had authorized Lumumba's murder, but said the plan was not carried out. In addition, records show that French diplomats in Africa at the time of Lumumba's murder were calling directly for the elimination of the Congolese leader. And so, there is no way around the fact that there was Western involvement in his assassination, and at the highest level. His death still haunts Congo today, but his legacy lives on, whether it is through references in popular culture, such as rap music, film, and theater. There's even a public square in Belgium in his name. Lumumba will forever be remembered as one of the fathers of independence of the Congo, one of the most visionary African leaders, and the man who did not shy away from defying and challenging colonialism, not for his sake, but the sake of his people, a nobility that cost him his life.
All right, welcome back to Africa's Lit. I'm your host, Daniela. A quick shout out to Eaton Hotel, where I am broadcasting live. Eaton Hotel is at 380 Nathan Road in Jordan, in Hong Kong. I wanted to shout out Africa Center for our selection of wonderful books that we all get to enjoy. And shout out to listeners on the other side of the globe, CITR 101.9 FM Campus and Community Radio. Just wanted to say hello and thanks for listening. So today, Africa's Lit, we are talking about The Poisonwood Bible, written by Barbara Kingsolver. This book was published in 1998, so Kingsolver definitely had at her hands a lot of research and or a lot of information available to go towards research for this book. Although it is a fictional story, she does tie in some bits of history using her kind of five narratives of the women of the Price family. So we are now up to date on who, when, where, and why. But how about a little what? What happens next with the Price family, right? Today's novel is very much about politics and a country's history, but it is also about a family that is falling apart at the hands of their patriarchal head. So what happens when Mr. Nathan Price is argued against? His meek wife and four daughters would never think of saying anything that went against him. And that kind of reminds me of my dad's meek wife, my mama, and the four of us. Also not going against anything that he said. The amount of times my dad has reminded us that he is ahead of the family, I cannot count. But yes, I do understand the not going to go against my dad thoughts. So it is a connection I had with the daughters of the Price family. And when you throw in the Bible, like on top of it, so it's not only like my dad's like, hey, I'm the head of this house. It's also like I am ordained by God and the Bible explains why. And here are the verses. I imagine the Price family has experienced the same. So I get it. So yes, what happens when that is challenged, right? So let's see how Mr. Nathan Price handles a heckler.
C'est juste, Tata Ndu said while they counted. We can all see with our own eyes it was fair. My father's face was red. This is blasphemy. He spread his hands wide as if casting out demons only he could see and shouted, there is nothing fair here. Tata Ndu turned directly to father and spoke to him in surprisingly careful English, rolling his R's, placing every syllable like a stone in a hand. Tata Price, white men have brought us many programs to improve our thinking, he said. The program of Jesus and the program of elections. You say these things are good. You cannot say now they are not good. A shouting match broke out in the church, mostly in agreement with Tata Ndu. Almost exactly at the same time, two men yelled, Kunianga Ingeye Uyele Kutala. Anatole, who'd sat down in his chair a little distance from the pulpit, leaned over and said quietly to Father, they say you thatched your roof, and now you must not run out of your house if it rains. Father ignored this parable. Matters of the spirit are not decided at the marketplace, he shouted sternly. Anatole translated. Abukwe? Where then? Asked Tata Nguza, standing up boldly. In his opinion, he said, a white man who has never even killed a bushbuck for his family was not the expert on which God can protect our village. When Anatole translated that one, Father looked taken aback. Where we come from, it's hard to see the connection. Father spoke slowly as if to a half-wit. Elections are good, and Christianity is good. Both are good. We and his family recognize the danger in his extremely calm speech and the rise in color creeping toward his hairline. You are right. In America, we honor both these traditions, but we make our decisions about them in different houses. Then you may do so in America, said Tata Ndu. I will not say you are unwise, but in Kilanga, we can use the same house for many things. Father blew up. Man, you understand nothing. You are applying the logic of children in a display of childish ignorance. He slammed his fist down on the pulpit, which caused all the dried-up palm fronds to shift suddenly sideways and begin falling forward one at a time. Father kicked them angrily out of the way and strode toward Tata Ndu, but stopped a few feet short of his mark. Tata Ndu is much heavier than my father, with very large arms, and at that moment seemed more imposing in general. Father pointed his finger like a gun at Tata Ndu, then swung it around to accuse the whole congregation. You haven't even learned to run your own pitiful country. Your children are dying of 100 different diseases. You don't have a pot to piss in, and you're presuming you can take or leave the benevolence of our Lord Jesus Christ. If anyone had been near enough to get punched right then, my father would have displayed unchristian behavior. It was hard to believe I'd ever wanted to be near him myself. If I had a prayer left in me, it was that this red-faced man, shaking with rage, would never lay a hand on me again. Tata Ndu seemed calm and unsurprised by anything that had happened. "Ah, Tata Price," he said in his deep, sighing voice, "you believe we are Mwana, your children, who knew nothing until you came here. Tata Price, I am an old man who learned from other old men. I could tell you the name of the great chief who instructed my father and all the ones before him, but you would have to know how to sit down and listen. There are 122. Since the time of our Munkulu, we have made laws without help from white men." He turned toward the congregation with the air of a preacher himself. Nobody was snoozing now, either. "Our way was to share a fire until it burned down, i.e., to speak to each other until every person was satisfied. Younger men listened to older men. Now the Belizi tell us the vote of a young, careless man counts the same as the vote of an elder." In the hazy heat, Tata Ndu paused to take off his hat, turn it carefully in his hands, then replace it above the high dome of his forehead. No one breathed. "White men tell us, vote, Bantu. They tell us you do not all have to agree. Ce n'est pas nécessaire. If two men vote yes and one says no, the matter is finished. Abu, even a child can see how that will end. It takes three stones in the fire to hold up the pot. Take one away, leave the other two, and what? The pot will spill into the fire." We all understood Tata Ndu's parable. His glasses and the tall hat did not seem ridiculous. They seemed like the clothes of a chief. "But that is the white man's law, n'est-ce pas?" he asked. "Two stones are enough. Il nous faut seulement la majorité." "It's true. That's what we believed. The majority rules. How could we argue?" I looked down at my fist, which still clutched my pebble. I hadn't voted, nor mother either. How could we, with father staring right at us? The only one of us who'd had the nerve was Ruth May, who marched right up and voted for Jesus so hard her pebble struck the cross and bounced. But I guess we all made our choices, one way or the other. Tata Ndu turned to father and spoke almost kindly. "Jesus is a white man, so he will understand the law of la majorité, Tata Price. Wenda Mbote." Jesus Christ lost 1156.
All that work. Did it pay off? What is the Democratic Republic of Congo's current religious status? Well, according to Wikipedia, the Democratic Republic of Congo is a secular nation and freedom of religion is enshrined in its constitution. As of 2021, the U.S. State Department reported that more than 95% of the population is affiliated with Christian denominations, of which nearly half are Roman Catholic, another half are Protestant, and a small number are Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, and Greek Orthodox. The remaining 5% follow other non-Christian religions, such as Islam, the Baha'is, Jews, and indigenous religions.
Thank you.
what about now? It's 2024. What is happening in the DRC today?
We are at Camp Ngoma for displaced people, where thousands of people are seeking shelter. They say they have nowhere else to go. The situation is dire, and this is because of fighting that has been going on between government forces and M23 rebels. This is North Kivu province in eastern DRC on the border with Rwanda. This province is rich in minerals like coltan, which is used in almost all electronics. Over the past few decades, more than 100 armed groups have fought for control of the region. But recently, fighting has escalated between M23 and Congo Army forces. In 2 years, 1 million people have been displaced because of the fighting.
We are always running. We don't get rest. I don't know what to do. I'm just praying for peace.
The DRC, the US, and the UN say M23 is funded and supported by Rwanda. Rwanda denies these claims. Human rights groups say atrocities have been committed by both fighting sides. Property has been destroyed, and women have also been raped. M23 fighters are on hills near the town of Sake. A coalition of government forces is trying to push them back. If Sake falls, it means that it will be very easy for M23 to march on to Goma, and more people here will continue suffering.
So for your reference, M23 is the March 23 movement, often abbreviated as M23, and also known as the Congolese Revolutionary Army. It is a Congolese rebel military group that is for the most part formed of ethnic Tutsi. Now, based in eastern areas of the DRC, it operates mainly in the province of North Kivu. And I'm sure that the term or the word Tutsi brings to mind the Rwandan genocide. So the DRC is a neighbor to Rwanda on its eastern side. And it looks like, that's kind of where that M23 group is founded. And you heard in the clip that the claims are that Rwanda is funding the M23, but there's news to dispute that. One question I guess we all have sometimes is, you know, why? Why is there always conflict? Why is a democratic republic always fighting? And there's never any forward movement. What's going on in the DRC? So I am a kindergarten teacher, and there are times in the class when I feel like all I do for the whole time I'm in class with these students, the children, is I'm putting out fires. I am always dealing with issues and complaints, or like just behavior that is not conducive to the classroom. And I get upset on the inside, because I can't move forward. I can't move ahead with any lessons, with any planning. I can't teach anything because I'm constantly dealing with little problems happening all around the classroom from one to the next. So that's my class of maybe 15 children. How can a country like the Democratic Republic of Congo, with a population of 99 million, ever move forward with building itself, with planning and executing those lesson plans, if it is always dealing with inner turmoil? There is someone must be benefiting. But who?
The simplification of this complex issue presented sometimes by the media is like this. Congo has known a conflict since 1996. And this conflict is being waged by two of Congo's neighbors, who are U.S. and British allies on the so-called war on terror. These two neighbors are Rwanda and Uganda. They invaded the Congo in 96. They invaded the Congo in 98. And up until today, even though peace accord has been signed, they continue to support proxy rebel militias in DRC. Why? Congo is a land endowed with so much mineral resources. Right, we have gold, we have cobalt, we have coltan, we have tin, we have diamonds, right? the wealth of the DRC as being the source of some of the conflict that we see in DRC. And these two Congos are neighbors. They've invaded the Congo. They've occupied territories. Even worse, if I remember correctly, in around 1999 and also in 2001, these two nations actually fought each other on Congolese soil, right? Rwanda and Uganda actually fought each other on Congolese soil. You know why they fought each other in the Congo? They fought each other over a diamond mine. They both wanted control of a mine. And when they fought each other, they dropped 4,000 bombs in the city of Kisangani. This is what, and that conflict, we call it also the Six-Day War, where up until today, the victims of that conflict have never received any reparation or any justice, even though the United Nations issued the strong condemnation of the killings of Congolese. So what the U.S. has done in the conflict is, one, they've provided cover for their allies in the region. Documentation of Rwanda and Uganda's invasions exists. Yet, the U.S. government every year continued to back Rwanda militarily, back Uganda militarily. Why? Some people may not know that you have Ugandan soldiers in Iraq, in Afghanistan. You have Rwandan soldiers playing interest operations across the African continent, and also France interests across the African continent, where you have Rwandan soldiers in Mozambique. You have Rwandan soldiers in Central African Republic. They were also at some time years ago, they were in Mali under the UN missions there. So, but the U.S. every year continued to give millions of dollars to these militaries, having the evidence that these countries are committing crimes in the DRC. So that's the U.S. hands from the government side. But then from the corporation side, numerous reports have been published of U.S. corporation and other international corporation who have pilfered illegally Congo's minerals. I think in 2002, there was a report published by the UN group of experts documenting 85 companies illicitly trading or accessing Congo's minerals. Up until today, nothing happened to these companies. So there is a tacit support of the U.S. to invaders, and there is complicity of the U.S. by not holding companies and their allies accountable for crimes committed in the DRC.
And that information was found on Breakthrough News' YouTube channel. That was 4 months ago, so it's a very recent conversation. On that note, I will bid you adieu. Much love and gratitude again to my family over at Africa Center, Eaton Workshop, CITR, Campus and Community Radio, and to my husband, with whom I celebrated another happy anniversary this past weekend. With all the strife, I wish for peace.
Yoka mobali na yo, akubele la yo, nakata tu refele bisengo o. Okilo mingi sabana moka.
For all those wondering, this is Papa Wemba with Matebu.
C'est ça, de temps en temps, oh, comme la kanga, Akadia Panama, ma témoué. Mère Nanga, ma
is your host, Jamal Steeles. Also in the studio with me, we got Young Malik over on the boards. Also, big shout-outs to the homeboy Jules, Horsepower, Relly Rels, Brendan Butters, Rico Uno, and you. Yes, you for fucking with us on a weekly basis. Of course, we got nothing but slaps for that head top. We got some oldies but goodies. We got some special guests making their way to the studio as well. If this is your first time tuning in with us, big shouts to you. Remember, you can also check us out on the internet, CITR.ca, or you can check us out live on Twitch right now, twitch.tv/crimesandtreasons, if you want to see what it looks like inside the studio. Also,